And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
So after almost 12 years of surprise, suspicion and scandal, it's finally time for Qatar to host the FIFA World Cup. I'm Adam Leventhal here in Doha and this is the Athletic Football Podcast.
The winner to organize the 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
Today, I have very strong feelings. I can tell you that.
I'm still sort of, getting over processing some of it,
which was a kind of greatest hits of whataboutery.
You don't have a World Cup just with stadiums. You need roads, you need hotels, you need irrigation systems, you need a whole infrastructure to be able to host it. So migrant workers built Qatar.
So welcome to the first of our daily podcasts throughout this World Cup tournament in Qatar. Here with me is Matt Slater, our senior football news reporter, as we build up to the start of this tournament. It's all beginning this evening, Qatar against Ecuador. Our England correspondent Jack Pitt-Brook is going to be bringing us the latest from the England camp a little bit later on. We'll also be hearing from Simon Hughes, who's done a special report on the situation faced by migrant workers in Nepal. Now, Matt, it's good to see you. It's been a surprising start already to the preamble to this tournament. We'll come on to Gianni Infantino in a moment's time. But from your point of view, it's here, it's starting, it's happening. We're sat in a hotel in Qatar. Can you quite believe that we've got to this point and it's actually here and it's real?
Yes, I can. But it has been a long time. They were awarded the right to host the World Cup 12 years ago. That was the shocking bit, to be fair. And there were many obstacles to clear. First of all, moving it to the winter. The number of challenges that sort of came about from, you know, good reporting and from whistleblowers, you know, just around the process, how they won that vote. You know, getting over all of those at times sort of felt like a bit of an achievement for Qatar, and you sort of think, well, are they going to redo the vote? Is it going to be relocated? Are they going to be forced to share the World Cup with Saudi Arabia? You know, then we get it to things like 2017 when they fall out with their neighbours. So to answer your question, no, I'm not surprised, because Qatar has held on despite all of that. And I've just glossed over so many other episodes. The Garcia report, which was a 3-year saga, this independent investigation into the process. So many stories that you know I've forgotten writing.
But just reeling them off there, it's felt like a horse race almost. These hurdles they've had to get over, and they've managed to do it. But that's almost reflective on the fact that FIFA, they wanted it. It was never ever going to really be put anywhere else, was it, after all this, even after all the controversy?
Well, some people at FIFA wanted it. Let's not forget that Sepp Blatter didn't want it here. I think it was that the process was so poor, so bad. Never mind allegations of corruption. I'm just going to park those for a bit. People make their own minds up on that. And if you want a refresher, I've written about it. There's books out there. But equally, there's a pretty good, well, very good Netflix documentary on it. So there's no shortage of sources for that type of the story. If you want the corruption story, it's out there. The process was dreadful, though. It was just awarding two at once. It just made vote trading a racing certainty, to use the horse racing analogy, just the actual voting mechanism they used. It's just a really bad process. So it was on FIFA. And very quickly, I think key people at FIFA realised that we're on the hook here legally. They have won this. Qatar has won this. I'm doing the little quotey things with my fingers, fair and square, in that they played the game. We can't take it from them unless we have an absolutely cast iron, stand up in court, see you at Court of Arbitration for Sport reason to take it from them. And they never really did. So there's that. And also, I think Sepp Blatter, for reasons I won't go into now because it is watch Netflix, quickly did a deal with Qatar. Tell you what, I'll call the dogs off in terms of taking the World Cup from you if you call the dogs off in terms of taking my job from me. Because there was a guy called Mohammed bin Hamman who was the boss of Asian football, one of FIFA's vice presidents, who wanted to run against him in 2011. So there was a deal, there were various deals done to win the vote, and then there were big deals done afterwards to you and I, through thick and thin, we'll get you over the line, yeah. FIFA. We'll get you over the line, Qatar. So that is part of the story as to why we're here.
And I think, you know, it's interesting to mark that, to mark the story when it is about to start. And that's why we did it. If you think that we're going back over old history, it's important that now we are here, ready for the tournament to kick off, that people understand that it has been one hell of a ride. It was one hell of a speech yesterday from Gianni Infantino, yesterday, that the precursor to the tournament, it's a tradition, isn't it, for the FIFA president to speak to the media, to delegates, prior to the tournament. And you've written a piece which is pulling it apart, and people will have heard the initial part of that speech and just thought, what is going on here? Just describe what it was like being in that room. And if you wish to refresh us on anything that was said, I mean...
Today, I have... very strong feelings, I can tell you that. Today I feel Qatari. Today I feel Arab. Today I feel African. Today I feel gay. Today I feel disabled. Today I feel a migrant worker. I think for what we Europeans have been doing in the last 3,000 years around the world, we should be apologizing for the next 3,000 years.
Well, you're right. Remarkable. I'm still sort of, getting over processing some of it, which was a kind of greatest hits of whataboutery and straw men arguments. Now, you're right. It is a tradition for the FIFA president to speak to the media the day before. And they nearly always start off with opening remarks. Gianni Infantino's opening remarks lasted for 1 hour. I transcribed them. It was just under 5,000 words. And normally, we would also hear from the hosts. They would normally try and own this moment. We've not heard a thing from them. They've certainly not made themselves available to the international media. They don't need to, though, because they've clearly been in Gianni Infantino's ear, and he just basically ran through their talking points. And it really was also, as I said, a greatest hits of whataboutery. And if you've been reporting on Qatar for the last few years, you'll be very familiar with these. And I can boil them down, really, into a few simple sentences. All criticism of Qatar's record on migrant workers, the hundreds of thousands of people that built the infrastructure for this World Cup, and the other processes that are going on in Qatar, its own nation-building projects, its record on human rights, women's rights, LGBT rights, etc., etc. It's all hypocrisy. Influenced by racism. Strongly influenced by racism. So if you agree with Gianni Infantino, nobody from the West can criticize, can raise concerns at all, apparently. And the I feel element of his speech was because he has decided he understands how all those people feel. He can put himself in their shoes, because as a young boy, as the son of economic migrants in Switzerland, his parents were from Italy, and because he had red hair and freckles, and he was bullied at school for his red hair, he knows what it's like to be a foreigner in a foreign country. He knows what it's like to... He's seen the experience of migrant workers, and he knows what it's like to sort of be not the cool kid. And his point is that he engaged. Now, this is, I think, is a sort of the central theme of his speech, but also his approach to life, is that engage, talk. Power of sport. Now, you hear this quite a lot. It becomes this sort of catch-all excuse, this get-out-of-jail-free card for any kind of moral dilemma that a sporting official can find themselves in. Got a World Cup in Russia, got to cozy up to Vladimir Putin. Don't worry, I'm engaging, everybody. This is not cozying up. This is not endorsing. I'm engaging. I'm talking, because sport is inherently good, and by playing sport together, we'll understand each other better and we'll fight less. Well, how did that go in Russia? Because looking back now, it actually feels like we did endorse Russia. We did embolden Russia. Don't forget that Russia had already invaded Ukraine in 2018, had already got involved in Syria, had already poisoned people in Salisbury, endangering large numbers of British innocent people. Don't worry, let's forget all that, because we were engaging. And what message did Vladimir Putin take from that, from all the photo opportunities, from Gianni Infantino at every available opportunity, saying how amazing Russia is, how welcoming Russia is? What message did Putin take from that? Guys, I can do whatever I like. Look what I've done already, and they give me this World Cup, and this guy comes over here and tells us how amazing we are, and it's the greatest advert, the greatest spokesman for Russia that I could imagine. I think we all know what happened next. And then it's amazing in his speech. I mean, I was getting increasingly angry about it, and then sort of amused by it, and then angry about it again, because he just raced through examples of, well, what about this? What about that? And you're like, Johnny, just think about the next step. Just carry on with that logic. Because if you did a little bit more thinking, you'd have the answer to your own question that you posed. That, oh, actually, maybe we should be asking more questions about it. And actually, now I think about it, that's not a very good excuse for that Qatari policy, or that very shoddy promise they haven't quite delivered on. And yes, okay, you've got these new projects to announce, but how about the other stuff that they haven't quite delivered yet on? Workers' right reforms, on unpaid wages, on compensation funds. All the experts say, yeah, the policy's fine. How about the implementation? Should we focus on implementation for a little bit, Charlie? So it just went on and on and on and on. And in amongst it all was that it's our fault, actually our fault in the room, the journalists, that we have been misreporting this, misrepresenting people. And I was looking around, and of course, the big arch FIFA critics from the minute one were like, you know, chomping at the leash to have a pop at him, thinking, oh my, you know, I'm going to get us have a go in 10 minutes. No, it's 59 minutes. You've just got to sit back and wait. By the end, everyone in the room, even the more mild-mannered, conservative, yeah, FIFA's fine, everyone calmed down, journalists, looked like they'd been slapped around the face. The air had been sucked out of the room with everybody gasping. And everyone was a bit dazed. When the questions came, it was a little bit dissipated. I mean, maybe that was the whole, you know, yeah. If I completely confuse everybody and upset everybody so they don't know which news line to go on. Because, by the way, he drops four or five news bombs in there as well. Like, oh, I've been to North Korea, by the way. Did I mention that? I tried to persuade North Korea to co-host a Women's World Cup with South Korea. It didn't work. But I would go 100 times to persuade them to do something like that. There was some remarkable stuff in there. But anyway, I'm ranting now. That's what happens when you listen to a man rant for an hour.
What I wanted to find out from you, in addition to that, and it's well worth reading the piece that Matt has done on The Athletic today, is the impact of that speech, not on the journalist that he was almost targeting, but on the Qataris who'd organised this tournament. Yes, I mean, you said at the beginning there, it was almost as if he was parroting what they had said, and he was almost a puppet, it seemed, or it could be argued. But it was an opportunity to try and move away from the issues and deal with them in a grown-up way. But it's almost just put more fuel on this fire to almost ensure that it kicks on when the football does start. Or do you not think? Do you think it will actually now move away from all these issues?
Well, a couple of things that immediately spring to mind. Whether the speech does that or not, I don't know. I suspect not, because we're all incensed about it. And last night, yesterday, the reaction was almost universal from what I could see. Yeah. That this was a badly conceived speech, poorly delivered. Yes, you absolutely hear every Qatari talking point, every single one. And it was, the timing was interesting, because it came 24 hours after the Budweiser beer U-turn, which I don't think, it's not the biggest deal in the world. Yes, we're in a conservative Muslim country. Okay, we, you know, fans can't drink for a few hours around the stadium. That in isolation is not a big deal. It becomes a big deal because it happened 2 days before the start of the World Cup. It came after, you know, everyone assumed that it was going to be okay, that they'd already, you know, it was already done in a very kind of sensitive way, seemingly. Budweiser, certainly, it was a shock to them. They have a $75 million, you know, sponsorship contract. This is clearly a breach of that contract. No question, by the way. I don't think Budweiser are going to be that upset, because they've got the World Cup rights for 2026 in the States, which, of course, is their massive market, and they're not going to walk away from this relationship. But it was a breach of contract. Absolute breach of contract that was forced on them by, forced on FIFA by the Qataris. And the perception, almost universal, is that that was Qatar's revenge. That was Qatar's FU moment, if I'm allowed to say that, for the coverage. And it was a slap round the face to FIFA. Get a grip. Why can't you control the media? Why can't you control the message? You're not being a big enough cheerleader. So what do we get? 24 hours later, we get the speech. Now, will it work? Will any of this work? Could anything of Infantino have said worked? No. But he did say something pretty sensible in amongst. He said a few sensible things. I mean, he spoke for an hour. It wasn't all dreadful. It was just wrapped up in a sandwich of nonsense. Once the ball, and he touched the ball, once this thing starts rolling, the magic of the game takes over. We've been to so many multi-events. I mean, there's a long list where the coverage going in has been negative. The main stories, the narrative has been, oh, problems, problems, problems. Then the sport starts. Amazing performances, upsets, goals, etc., etc., etc. Conversation changes. That could still happen, and I strongly suspect it will still happen. I'm not going to forget the last 12 years. I'm not going to forget the lecture I got from someone who has no right to lecture. I'm not going to forget the lesson of morality that he gave me. And I will be back. He said he'll be back. He said he'll make sure that Qatar keeps its promises. Great. Great. Well, I'm willing to talk to him about that.
Matt, thank you. That was almost rousing. We will hold you to it. And I look forward to Slater versus Infantino part two a little bit later on in the tournament. Matt will, of course, be here throughout this World Cup. Let's now check in on some of the other big stories making the headlines, both here in Qatar and also around the world. We'll be hearing from our England correspondent, Jack Pitbrook, very, very shortly. Before that, I caught up with David Ornstein and our Manchester United writer Laurie Whitwell at the Portugal training camp yesterday, once they let us in. It was rather oversubscribed, as you can imagine. Following Cristiano Ronaldo's explosive interview, there was just one story in town, with everyone wanting a piece of the action.
I've been to a lot of media activity and venues since I've been here in the few days since arriving, but nothing has been as frenzied as this that I've seen so far. Maybe Argentina with Messi, but this is a massive sense of expectation around Cristiano Ronaldo. It would have been in normal circumstances, but given what's going on at Manchester United now, it's probably the biggest story within the football world at the moment. I think seeing an interview like that from a player under contract is pretty much unprecedented, but even the fact that he gave the interview, then the nature of it, has cast a huge shadow over one of the biggest players in the world and one of the biggest clubs in the world, and it's all come to this tiny part of Qatar. So we bombed it up out of town, and then got here. Laurie was already inside, like the eager beaver he is. You and I got trapped outside, which is rare. You don't have to sign up for press conferences and filming opportunities like this. You normally just turn up. But the press conference was full. There was a massive queue outside, which we were part of. Laurie was inside, and now we're out at training. So I'll hand it over to the main man.
It is, as David says, the story that everyone's focused on. It's just so unusual. I don't know if I've heard of a situation like it when a player of that stature at a club of that scale, they're talking about sacking him and starting the legal process and making a statement about it on the eve of a World Cup. I mean, obviously Cristiano Ronaldo has brought this on himself by giving the interview and being so provocative in it, even though if some of the things he said did have valid reasons, you know, he criticised some of the aspects of Manchester United, which I think are reasonable, but nonetheless the reason for him doing the interview, it seems plain to me, is to force an exit from Manchester United. The question now is, will he accept a parting of the ways with no wages that are owed to him, or will it get messy and will United have to actually crank it up from a position of wanting to terminate his contract by mutual consent and go a step further?
My feeling on that is that they've been quite aggressive from the outset to try and put their marker in the sand. We want to get rid of him. He's been in breach of his contract, brought the club into disrepute, caused damage reputationally to Manchester United, but he will obviously have his side of the story to that, and if this is dealt with in a mature way, they then might reach a middle ground and a compromise, but that will take negotiation. And so however swiftly United want it dealt with, it's probably not going to be imminent. But I think the reality is that this guy that we're all watching here is never going to pull on a Manchester United shirt again. He may not set foot in Carrington other than to clear his locker out.
Hi, it's Jack Pitbrook here. I'm recording this on Saturday evening. I've spent the last 4 days down at the England camp in Al Wakra in southern Doha, where England have been doing all their training and also doing all their media activity in the build-up to their opening game against Iran on Monday. And it's been fun. It's been a really impressively run England camp so far, I think. All the players we've spoken to, and so far James Maddison, Connor Cody, Aaron Ramsdale and Eric Dyer have all done press conferences. They've all done, you know, they've all been very positive. They've all been very impressed with the work the FA's done. Clearly the big challenge really is twofold. One is that there's such a short turnaround time between the players meeting up in St George's Park on Monday, flying to Qatar on Tuesday, starting training on Wednesday. So only a small number of training sessions before the Iran game on Monday. And the other, of course, is the temperature. You know, it is extremely hot here. It's been very hot all week, particularly in the day. You know, 30 plus most of the time. And that creates a big problem for the players to get used to. Now, we are told, of course, that there will be air conditioning inside the stadiums. I think it's safe to say we'll believe it when we see it. I think it might be that in the stands the air conditioning is good. On the pitch, it might be slightly harder. So it's been a difficult transition for the FA to get into preparation mode for these games, but I do think they are doing a pretty good job of it. In terms of the match itself, well, my information is that I think neither James Maddison nor Kyle Walker are likely to be involved. So England might have to choose a different team than what some people would have expected. I don't know at this point what the formation would be. I think going into it, people would have expected to be a 3-4-3. But the more I think about it, the more I think, oh, maybe it'll actually be a 4-3-3. Ultimately, we'll probably find out on Sunday or Monday. Gareth Southgate's giving his kind of FIFA-organised pre-match press conference at 4:15 on Qatari time Sunday afternoon at the main media centre in the middle of Doha. And then on Monday afternoon at the Khalifa International Stadium, we've got the game against Iran. So really looking forward to coming back on one of the podcasts then and talking about it.
Next, we'll be discussing how Qatar has managed to build up Doha and ultimately the country in the space of a decade in order to host the world's biggest sporting event. But we'll be discussing the human cost that has come with it.
Hello there. This upcoming World Cup, what are the Athletic going to be doing about it? Well, I'm James Richardson, and every night I'll be hosting a Totally Football show with the likes of Raphael Honigstein, James Horncastle, and the rest of the Totally crew. Then every morning from Qatar, wham, the Athletic Football Podcast will be at you with David Ornstein, Matt Slater, Adam Crafton, and many more. There'll also be World Cup content from Adam Hurry's Football Clichés podcast, Michael Cox's insightful Athletic Football Tactics podcast, and Joe Devine's TIFO podcast, with all the stories that matter from Qatar. All in all, The Athletic is your essential audio companion for the upcoming World Cup.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
So this is Adam Leventhal here with the Athletic Football Podcast, the first of our daily episodes for you throughout the tournament. Joining us now is the Athletic's Simon Hughes, who, head of the tournament, has been to Nepal to report on the harrowing personal accounts of those who have either worked as migrant workers in Qatar or, sadly, who have had family members or loved ones die during the building of this country. Simon, we'll get into the details of your 8-day trip and the article that is now out on The Athletic. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on hearing Gianni Infantino, the FIFA president, sat in Doha, knowing what you know, and saying something like,
"Today I feel a migrant worker."
How do you react, and how do you think those who heard that, who have been affected, would react?
I thought it was the most insensitive thing anybody could say ahead of the World Cup. I'd be really interested to know how many people migrant workers Infantino has actually stood in front of and listened to. Maybe he has in Qatar, but very much doubt he's gone around the world to countries like Nepal, Bangladesh, India, Sri Lanka, and actually listen to the stories of the people who've suffered because of this. He tried to sort of reason that as a ginger man with freckles, that he understands where everybody's coming from. Well, I'm a ginger man with freckles, and it doesn't give me license to speak on behalf of lots of people who have suffered in this World Cup process. I think he's either trying to wrestle with his conscience or deliberately disguise some of the things that have gone on. I think even if one person dies in the building of the World Cup, it's an absolute tragedy, and the story would deserve, you know, all the coverage that it gets. But to have this many people, I know the numbers contested by Qatar, there's various numbers flying about. Infantino said earlier this year that only three people in Qatar have died working with the, you know, on the stadiums. Well, when I went to Nepal, I met three people alone in Nepal in 8 days who had passed away, sadly. And yeah, I listened to the speech yesterday, and in any normal, rational world, after that speech, he should be under pressure to resign. That's my view. And I think people listening to, if you were a migrant worker and listened to that, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of them, obviously, but I haven't been deeply, deeply moved by listening to the people's stories. I was just really angry. I was like, how dare you say that?
There are so many powerful descriptions and quotes in the piece about your experiences. And I mean, let's be quite sort of clear about it in terms of the numbers of people that, and I know you say that they were contested, but those who have died from Nepal is put at 2,100 rather than these tiny numbers which are being put out there by Infantino and by the Qatari organisers of the World Cup. One of the quotes that really jumped out was, Qatar has been built on the blood and sweat of Nepalese. From the people that you spoke to, and you obviously heard from families of people who have lost their lives, what was their take on this as a World Cup, as what it was as a project?
Well, the guy who said that, actually, he went to Nepal in 1999. And this is where the conversation has been diluted, I would say, by FIFA. And they've gone along with the Qatar line of, you know, well, it's stadium deaths relating, sorry, deaths relating to the stadiums. The reality is Qatar has been built, you know, in a very short space of time, and it would not have been possible without migrant workers from countries like Nepal. So this guy, when he went in 1999, described the scene in Doha, and you know, there was nothing there, basically. It was a relatively small sort of fishing port. The whole country needed to be built to a point where they could convince FIFA and other FIFA members, you know, FIFA members, that it was possible to host this World Cup. I mean, that there was a rapid development in the country over a 10-15 year period, which impressed a lot of people. You know, that's before we get into the conversation about how they actually won the World Cup. You know, I know obviously there's a lot being written about that, but there is the reality that, you know, without, you don't have a World Cup just with stadiums. You need roads, you need hotels, you need irrigation systems, you need a whole infrastructure to be able to host it. So migrant workers built Qatar. I think there's, I think it's 90% of its workforce in Qatar are migrant workers. So that has to be remembered. I think anybody, when you focus on the stadiums alone, it's not enough. It's just not enough. You know, that this story is actually, it's not 12 years old. It's 25, 30 years old, really, in the making. And, you know, very clear to me that a lot needed to happen even before Qatar won the right to host the World Cup, to put it in that position.
Just take us through some of the stories that you heard in terms of the conditions that those who went from Nepal to Qatar were working in.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, you see. So a lot of Nepalese workers come from the south of the country. It's a very poor part of the world that they're being exploited, essentially. You know, low educated, not often, you know, skilled workers. They go into Qatar and learn on the job, essentially. So they're not familiar with what working standards should be. And I feel awkward saying that because it sounds like I'm patronising them, but that is the reality of the situation. So a lot of the workers, some of the workers that I met didn't realise that what they were being subjected to was wrong and would be wrong in any country. Under a FIFA umbrella, it makes it absolutely stink to high heaven that this has happened. Now, a lot of people, the main thing that people would speak about was the heat. You know, the actual, you know, reality of building a road. So while you're in Qatar, you might go, you know, across the Salwar Road, which connects the whole of the country, basically. That road was built by migrant workers. They would work in 50-degree heat often. So this predates Qatar winning the World Cup. But it still happened as recently as 2016 that workers would be asked to work through the midday heat in the summer. Since then, there have been reforms, and it is, in theory, there's more safeguarding measures to stop workers working in that temperature. But can you imagine how hot it must be in 50-degree heat with PPE gear on? It was exhausting. There was, particularly in the middle of the desert, there was a lack of shade. And people would only have a certain amount of water given to them per day. And once that water ran out, it was up to them really to try and source their own water. So I remember one migrant worker telling me about, like, he realised pretty quickly that the only place to get cold water would be in the mosque. So he would spend his night running around mosques trying to stock up on cold water for the next day, because if you got caught in the middle of the day without any water, the only option would be to go to use one of the street taps, which will be hot. So you're basically feeding boiling hot water. You know, you're fueling yourself on boiling hot water, which is obviously not a nice thing to think about. So, I mean, that is a basic thing that people really found difficult, the heat. I mean, Nepal is a warm country which is suffering from global warming, but working in the Gulf, particularly in the summer, is a totally different experience for a lot of people. We could get into conversations about the camps and sort of how crowded they were, living on top of each other, very little personal space. People tended not to complain so much about that, really. It was more the very raw human things that people would suffer from, like the heat, or they were aware as well of how, you know, the safety standards as well, like certain things should have not been happening. So there's one guy whose wife I met who fell off a scaffolding last year. She showed me a picture of what she thought to be that scaffolding. I'm laughing at it. I shouldn't be laughing, but it just looked like something that shouldn't be used for anything, never mind, you know, a major international football tournament. So people like him, he wasn't working on a stadium. He was working on a hotel. So people are reduced to being a number, basically. So that dehumanizes them again. And he would not be counted in Qatar's, measurements when it comes to looking at how many people have died in the country on the World Cup. But the guy who died had told his wife that during the World Cup, people will be coming to stay in this hotel, international visitors. For all, you know, there'll be people in a hotel somewhere in Qatar now where he was one of seven Qatari workers that died having fallen off the scaffold because it wasn't fit for purpose. And people are staying there now. So it's part of the World Cup, whether Qatar tries to argue otherwise.
I can completely understand that. Being in Doha right now, even speaking to a hotel manager who was not aiming to get his hotel open for the World Cup, but it was then forced through. It's reflective of the time pressure that people were put under across the board, and those who will have got the brunt of that would have been the people building the hotels, building the roads, as you say, building the stadiums, as you've mentioned. I wanted also just to get your thoughts on the fact of those who have returned back to Nepal, who, I suppose, thankfully they have come through the experience, but they've been left with illnesses, you know, mental, physical, and some also as well who have been left very, very short of money because of basically being sent back and told, well, we're done with you and we're not going to be paying you any longer. I mean, the levels of this are multiple, aren't they?
There are. I mean, the story that I've written, it tries to show that you know, that everybody loses something, really. It's not just a question for Qatar, I would say, across the world. I mean, there's a lot of migrant workers that go to different countries, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, and get treated badly. And for me, what it boils down to is this. We would not be having this conversation if people were paid fairly, because migrant workers are not paid fairly. Contrary to the report, you know, a lot of reporting, which is, I would say, inaccurate, is that, you know, people are sort of lured into Qatar by the promise of better pay. But if you were a construction worker in Nepal, the pay is pretty much the same. You know, the issue for Nepalese workers is that a lot of the work is irregular in their own country. So it means that Qatar offers them that supposed security of, you know, consistent pay, basically. So that is why they go. But they are going to Qatar off the back of paying a recruitment agent a fair amount of money, which they have to repay that loan. So they're in debt to get there in the first instance. Now, a few people have said to me, well, you know, it's a job for Nepal to sort that out. Well, yeah, I'd take that as well. Everybody should be looking at this and trying to see what they can do better. We would not be having this conversation if people went to countries like Qatar and were paid better, so that they can go home and invest their own money into a plot of land or to build a house. That's what people in Nepal basically want to do. So if they're paid better and they're treated well, you know, and not treated essentially like what one of the guys said to me, it feels like modern slavery, because you're not allowed out of Qatar. You're only ever allowed out of Qatar on the country's terms. You know, so there was one guy that I met in one of the poorest parts of Nepal, who only earlier this year, so July, he left Qatar. And that's what I wanted to show in the story, is that obviously the first guy that I met was in 1999, despite there have been reforms in Qatar, but you know, how useful those reforms have been for everyone. I think it maybe a few people have benefited from it, but not everyone. And I think particularly when you have a situation like this, whereby in the summer, there's a massive construction company which suddenly finds itself in problems. As many as 6,000 workers are affected by this. There's all sorts of rumour about why the company fell into hardship, but I had it confirmed off the Qatari government that the company was struggling, and that the people who were in charge of that company had legal action taken against them. But this left 6,000 workers without anywhere to go in a very short space of time. So the guy that I spoke to is now back in Nepal in debt. So he's in more debt than he was when he went out to Qatar. And I've never seen a person look so worried in my life. And I know it sounds like a bit of a mad thing to say, but I've never seen, you could see it in his face, and you know, looking into his eyes, you could see how scared he was about, you know, when are the loan sharks going to come for him, basically. So a lot of these workers who work for the company, I would say, because of a lack of trade unionism in Qatar, we're not trusting the information that they were getting handed down to them from government officials, which meant that they felt pressurized essentially to leave the country. Now, Qatar says that the workers who applied to move to another company had that facilitated for them. But certainly the guy that I met says that I didn't feel that was ever an option, because until recently it was against the law to move companies while you were in Qatar. And he felt that the message was rammed home that if you did that, that, you know, that you could face imprisonment, basically. So I would say that was another strand to it, that the lack of trade union representation meant that a lot of the information that was being spread around 6,000 workers at that time, there was a lack of trust in it. So it's something if Qatar was serious about improving its, you know, its work, its relationship with workers, it would grant trade unions. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I'm going to be fascinated to see after the World Cup whether a lot of the, I would say, progressive measures that they put in place on paper continues. And I think it's really important as journalists that we continue to shine a light on that.
Yeah, I completely agree. Simon, thank you very much indeed. And the piece, I Have No Hopes, Qatar's World Cup Workers Who Survived and the Families Torn Apart. That's the headline. You can read that now on The Athletic. So that is the first episode of The Athletic Football Podcast from here at the Qatar World Cup. Don't forget, you can keep in touch with all of the broader issues associated to the tournament, plus all the latest news like France, for example, losing out on another big name, the Ballon d'Or winner, Karim Benzema. On The Athletic, just head to theathletic.com/footballpod for our latest deal. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The Athletic.